This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Listening to All the Books, a weekly show of recommendations and enthusiasm regarding the week's new book releases. This is episode 307, and today we are talking about books being released on April 20th, 2021, and more. I'm Liberty Hardy, here with Tirzah Price, and we're coming to you from bookriot.com. Tirzah, hello!
Hi, Liberty!
How are you?
Great! I am well. It's a beautiful sunny day in Michigan. I'm getting my second COVID shot tomorrow. I'm excited.
Yeah. It is snowing and raining here in Maine, and I'm getting my first shot tomorrow. But how is life 1 week out from your first book launch?
Life is good. It's been a very busy whirlwind of a week. 2 weeks? I don't know. Time has slipped.
Has it been
into
2 weeks
something
already?
Meaningless. I don't
even know. Wow.
It feels like it's only been like 3 days, but yeah. Also maybe like a month. So yeah, but it's been great. Like, I'm so grateful for all the people who've been supportive and, you know, liked and commented and shared stuff on social media and have come to virtual events. I could not have asked for anything better for my first book launch.
Well, that's great. Everyone is reading it. I see so many pictures of it on Instagram. You can't miss it. I mean, you can see the cover from space. It's like that bright green. It's amazing.
It's kind of neon.
Amazing. I like to think that they picked that so it would match my office chair, like my bright green office chair. That's probably the reasoning I'm thinking.
Totally, totally. With that nice pink.
Yeah, that too. Oh yeah, it matches that too. I bought like an office convertible chair couch thingy like a couple months before they released your jacket. So I'm sure it was my influence. It's so I can take a nice nap in my office when I want to without like the cats running all over me. I can just like shut the door and like take a nap instead of them jumping up and down on my head and like leaving toys. Like, you know, I wake up in the morning sometimes when I'm in bed and I have like cat toys in the crook of my neck because they've been like giving me offerings all night.
That is hilarious. Cats are so weird.
So
I love
weird.
Them, but they're so weird.
Yeah. My favorite thing to remember about cats is that they would totally eat us if they were large enough.
This is very true.
But in, like, they'd almost command respect if they weren't so ridiculous.
They're totally absurd. I'm always looking at my two orange ones, and I'm like, what are you doing? But, like, I'm also kind of impressed that you worked your way into that situation right there.
Yeah. That reminds me. I'm just going to talk about nature for this whole episode. Cats and nature. Last week, I was watching this robin in our yard because all the robins are here visiting now. And this robin just ducked its head, and you're like, oh, it's getting a bug. He pulled this worm out of the lawn that was so long that it was like, it kept going. It was like when a magician's pulling a scarf out of its sleeve. It started like backing up, and you could even see it on the robin's face. It was like, I cannot believe how long this worm is. And it was funny. I was like, this is all the TV I need. Now let me go watch Columbo for 20 hours. But, you know, they're kind of different. I just started watching Columbo. Like, it's streaming on Peacock now, and I just started watching it less than a week ago. And my husband this morning is like, I noticed that there are 3 books in the house about Columbo. That was fast. And I was like, that's how I work. I want to know everything. I need to know everything right now.
It's like you go from 0 to 60. Just bam.
Yeah. It's like if I like something, I need to know everything right then. I like books. We haven't talked about books yet.
We should probably talk about books.
Yeah, that's fun. Before we do that, we are going to hear from our first sponsor.
Today's episode is brought to you by W.W. Norton and Company Incorporated. So, Negative Space by Jillian Linden follows a week in the life of an English teacher at a New York private school. At home, her children ask constant questions about mortality, and her husband offers occasional counsel between Zoom calls. At school, something happens. She accidentally witnesses an ambiguous, possibly inappropriate interaction between a teacher and a student, but how can she be sure of what she saw? Negative Space is a portrait of a woman caught between the pressures of what's normal and what isn't, and examines what we owe the people who depend on us in a fractured and indifferent world. It's a debut novel and a short novel. It's perfect if you want something quick and easy to carry around, but it's also thought-provoking. It takes place during the pandemic, but it's not pandemic-focused, and it really just looks at everyday anxieties in low-threat situations that have high consequences. So make sure to check out Negative Space by Jillian Linden, and thanks again to WW Norton and Company Incorporated for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers by Abraham Chang. So this is an interesting love story. It's great for fans of Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow and High Fidelity. It's set in the mid-90s at NYU. And it follows young Wang, who has gotten the advice of love through Chinese numerology from his uncle. So he believes that he will have seven great loves in his life. And then he meets Irena in 95. And she's like the best. She's brilliant, charismatic, quick-witted, funny. They fall in love. But the thing is, she's number six. So if he is to have seven great loves, does that mean his time with Irena is going to come to an end? So this is a love letter to Western pop culture, Eastern traditions, and being a first-generation New Yorker. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers by Abraham Chang, for sponsoring this episode.
Okay, Tirza, you are going to kick it off today.
All right, I'm excited. So my first pick is The Forest of Stolen Girls by June Herr. And it's really funny because I think that there are two books that I'm going to talk about this episode. I talked about the author's like previous books, like I think even in the same episode like last year. So if you ever wonder, you know, do authors really sometimes release a book exactly a year from, you know, their previous book? Sometimes that does happen. So I really enjoyed The Silence of Bones, which was June Herr's debut novel. It was a historical mystery set in 1800 Korea. And this one is another historical mystery set in the 1400s. It is about a young woman named Hwani who has a bit of a shady, dark, sad past. So when she and her little sister were younger, they were traveling through the woods with their father, and they actually got separated from him. And she doesn't remember anything about like what happened. All she remembers is that, you know, she woke up and like everybody was really upset. And so what actually happened was that they got separated from their father. They were missing for like a day. And then when people found them, they were like huddled behind this rock, and they were just like feet away from the body of a young woman who had been brutally murdered. And so Hwani doesn't remember anything. Her younger sister won't talk about it. And this has been like just like a really, you know, scary, shocking thing that happened to them. And it really changed their lives. So after this incident, Hwani's younger sister goes and she becomes an apprentice to the local shaman. And Hwani and her father leave the island where they live, and they head to the mainland of Korea, and they live there because her father gets a promotion. He's a police inspector. And so he's never been able to solve this crime of what happened to his daughters, or understand like maybe how his daughters were connected or what they might have seen. But then it's about 10 years later, I think, 13 young women just like vanished into the same forest that Hwani and her younger sister were lost in, and they don't come out. And it's like a really, really puzzling mystery. So her father goes to their hometown, home island, and he's going to like investigate this. And Hwani stays behind, but then he disappears as well. So now she is like, okay, I've got to figure out what happened to my father. And so she goes to the island and reconnects with her younger sister, who is like understandably a bit resentful of the fact that her father and older sister kind of abandoned her, even though they didn't exactly see it like that. You know, she had this apprenticeship, but she was like, I can't believe that you just left me behind. So Juani wants to, you know, solve this mystery and find her father. She's hoping that her father's still alive. And so as she is investigating, she's slowly, sort of tentatively reconnecting with her sister. There's a lot of resentment and anger there. And they have like this really, really frightening encounter in the woods where Juani's chasing a lead. Her sister follows her. And they see this man in this like painted white mask, and he is wielding a sword, and he comes after the sisters, and they barely escape with their lives. And then her younger sister tells her, like, yeah, that's the man who we saw in the woods when we were kids, and he killed that woman, and I think he has something to do with like these 13 missing girls. So it's really, really fascinating historical mystery. It's definitely got high stakes and danger, and it also really dives into like the very interesting history of the time period, which I admit that I know like next to nothing about. The island where they live, I don't think I mentioned this, it's called Jeju Island, and at this time period it's kind of being used as like a penal colony where convicts are sent there. But then it also has, you know, these communities of people who've lived there for a long time and who have like established villages. And so there's a lot of tension between, you know, how that island is being used and like the people who've lived there forever. And there's just a lot of really interesting historical details and practices that I just, you know, I don't know much about Korea's history, so everything is new to me, and everything's really fascinating and exciting to read. So that is The Forest of Stolen Girls by June Her, and I think she has another historical mystery out next year. Maybe I will get to tell you about it on the show again, but I just recommend both of her books highly.
Yay! I haven't read it yet because I know you are going to read it. And I actually, myself, am going to segue into a book about missing girls, so, you know, figure I could only read one of those a show. Before I start talking about this book, I do want to give you a heads up. I'm going to mention some seriously dark things, so if you are listening with children, you might want to skip over this part, because it is about a child murderer. It is a novel. It is called Girl, 11 by Amy Souter Clark. It is a new thriller, and I thought it was excellent. It's set in Minnesota, in the Twin Cities. 20 years ago, a serial killer known as the Countdown Killer was terrorizing the city. He kidnapped a young woman. She was like 22, I think. And after so many days, he murdered her and left her to be found. And then a few days later, or maybe it was while he was holding the first one, a girl who was 21 was kidnapped, and it followed the same pattern. And suddenly, like, it was like going in descending ages, like a 19-year-old, an 18-year-old. And the police were rushing to try and like figure out like who he was and how to stop him. And then it just stopped, and they didn't know why. Like, they were like, how far is this countdown going to go? Like, and it stopped after a while. And now El Castillo grew up in the Twin Cities. As an adult, she worked as a social worker, working with children first. But it became very hard for her. She got involved in a case that she felt was being handled incorrectly, and it almost caused her job, and she decided, like, she didn't want to do that anymore. So she now has a podcast in which she examines cold cases involving missing children. It has been fairly successful, both in popularity, and they have managed to solve a couple of cold cases, and they've also managed to expose like one case where someone wasn't actually missing. They were just hiding from their parents, and, you know, they solved the mystery of that. But people keep writing in and wanting to know, you know, why haven't you done anything about the Countdown Killer? Because, you know, that's a case right here where we live. Like, you should do the Countdown Killer. People keep emailing her, and she's sort of hesitant because, you know, she's like right there. He's there. Is he still out there? Like, he's in this area where she is. But she decides, I'm going to do it. I'm going to cover it. So she does a whole episode dedicated to the Countdown Killer, you know, and his disappearance like 20 years earlier. And someone emails her and says, I have some information. I think I know who it is.
Ooh.
But before she can really get this information, it becomes apparent, like, a girl goes missing. And it fits the pattern of the ages of the girls that he was kidnapping. And now she realizes, like, is it my fault? Did I wake the sleeping dragon, you know? And so she has to figure out who he is, what this information was that this person wanted to give her, before something else happens. I really like this addition of podcasts to mystery genres. I find that they're really interesting because, you know, there are so many of them. There are so many of us who are interested in them. I do find it, I think I've said this before, and it, I've seen it in a couple of the books that I've read with these podcasts. It's like, I have a podcast. I put up one episode. I have a million followers now. It's like, yeah, unless you're like Obama, that is not how that happens. You know, so I find that to be a bit unrealistic, but, you know, I thought this was really great. I think Ella is a really great character. She's very strong. She's very determined, but you can also see, you hear this about like armchair detectives too. Like the work is stressing her out and making her like physically ill, you know, because like, how can she sleep? How can she stop doing what she's doing? You know, how dare she, you know, go to bed when there are still more emails that she could read? And maybe those contain clues that are going to help her solve a case. And, you know, she just feels so guilty all the time about, you know, even taking any time for herself because she's gotten herself in this position where she might be able to help somebody, might be able to solve a case. And I found that to be very, very realistic. And I thought the ending was really great. And so I want to give content warnings that are, there are some very serious ones here. There is child endangerment, abuse, abduction, and murder, mentions of sexual assault and violence against women and children. It is called Girl, 11, it's like 1-1, not spelled out, by Amy Suter Clark.
Oh, that sounds really good. I'm adding that to my list right now.
Yeah, I really liked the ending. It didn't go the way I thought it would, and I thought that was great. It reminded me of this episode of Luther that I'm not going to tell you about because then you would, you would know what I was thinking of.
Okay. Well, yes, adding it to my TBR. So my next pick is 1,000 Minutes to Sunlight by Jen White, which is a middle grade novel. We're going in a completely different direction here. It is just a really great middle grade novel about Cora, who is a kid that really struggles with anxiety. She's about 11 or 12. And the way her anxiety sort of manifests in her life is that she becomes obsessed with counting seconds and like the passage of time. Like she has a ton of wristwatches and she always knows like exactly how like many seconds long her hug from her little sister lasts. And she's always counting down the minutes until the next thing is going to happen. And her parents are like somewhat supportive, but you can also tell that they really, really just don't get it. So another way that her anxiety manifests is that she kind of imagines her brain as like being this like separate entity from herself, where like her brain is always like interrupting her and telling her like, oh, you know, this is how it goes. And, you know, remember, you only have me. And it's like a very intrusive. And she kind of has told people like, oh, well, this is, you know, I might think this, but then my brain says otherwise. And they're always telling her like, you control your brain. But that's really not her experience. If to her, her brain is very much in charge and she doesn't always like that. So this is kind of her lived reality. And, you know, things are mostly okay, if not great, until one night she wakes up in the middle of the night because she hears something like a big thud, and she tiptoes out of her bedroom and she walks out into the living room and she sees her parents like carrying a passed out man into their living room and like putting him on the couch. And like the first thing that her mom does, which is, in my like opinion, horrible and terrible and absolutely awful for Cora's anxiety, is she tells her daughter like, oh, you know, go back to bed. You're just dreaming, which, you know, like, this isn't real, but like Cora knows it's real and it freaks her out, which like I can't blame her as a, you know, an adult or a kid, like that has to be very scary. And so like she wakes up the next morning and her parents aren't there and her aunt's there and nobody will tell her who this strange man is, and until she finally gets it out of her parents that he is her father's older brother who has struggled with addiction his entire life and he has just kind of resurfaced in their lives. And her parents are really distracted and upset and nobody's really explaining things to Cora. And so she just feels like really out of control. And that unfortunately manifests into some not so great behavior at school where she just kind of shuts down. She runs away from school when she gets overwhelmed. And so the school assigns her a friend, which she does not like. And it's like this kid who's just very, very enthusiastic and doesn't seem to be able to take a hint that Cora doesn't want to be his friend. And he sort of shadows her and helps her you know, navigate social life. So this is just, I don't know, I felt so strongly for Cora during this book. Like, and at times, like, I would get really angry at her parents because, you know, this is told from Cora's perspective. And so you are in her head and you know what she really needs and wants to hear from her parents, but her parents don't seem to see that. And so maybe I'm not supposed to be as angry at her parents as I was. They were not, like, objectively terrible parents. They were just very distracted and they don't really understand their daughter. Although I will say, that doesn't prove by the end of the book, but, like, I was very frustrated on behalf of this kid. And but it's really great novel, I think, that just really portrays anxiety in a way that I think if you don't experience that yourself, it does it in a way that, like, makes it make sense and really makes it feel real. So this is just a fantastic middle grade novel. It's 1,000 Minutes to Sunlight by Jen White.
Okay. Now, I have something completely different. It is called Crying in H Mart, a memoir by Michelle Zauner. I was crying from, like, the first page of this book, so I do want to give a heads up before I start discussing it that it does involve illness and the death of a parent. And the opening memoir was first in The New Yorker, and it's the opening essay of this memoir first appeared in The New Yorker. Zauner is a Korean-American. Her mother was Korean. Her father is white and from the United States. And they lived in Eugene, Oregon. And she was the only Asian-American student in her school. And she didn't have a lot of exposure to her mother's culture growing up in Eugene, Oregon. And even, like, the foods of her mother's culture, aside from, like, that one aisle in the grocery store, you know, that they have, like, some kinds of foods that are from other parts of the world. But as an adult, she visits an H Mart, which I had never heard of these, but apparently they're all over the country in cities. It's a store that is just filled with ingredients that you would use in Asian cuisine. And they also have, like, a food court on the second floor where you can go taste all kinds of foods that are already prepared for you. And Zauner goes to one of these. I liked it because the H in H Mart gets its name from the first letter from a Korean expression that translates roughly into one arm full of groceries. I just thought that was really great. And Zauner she's in this H Mart and she starts crying because she's thinking about her mother who died a few years earlier from cancer. And food was kind of their love language. They shopped together. Every other summer, she would go to Korea with her mother, stay with her mother's family, and enjoy the food there. And she talks about how her mother was not what she would call a mommy. She wasn't, like, very nurturing. She didn't, like, hang on every word that she said or everything that she wanted to show her. But she loved making food and serving food, and she would go out of her way to prepare the dishes that she knew people liked, or she would give them larger servings of the dishes. And that was kind of, like, how she showed how much she loved someone. So, like I said, every other summer, Zauner would visit her mother's sisters in Seoul, and she would just have this amazing experience. And also this experience, like, whereas she was growing up in Eugene, she was an only child. They lived in the woods. They couldn't see their neighbors. You know, now she's in a city where there are so many people around, and she just thought that was so interesting. And she, you know, was reminiscing about how she wishes she had had kind of this experience. She wishes that she had learned to speak Korean. She talks about how she doesn't know how to make the recipes that her mother used to make. And that her mom's instructions were always kind of vague when she would tell her about them. Something like, you know, stir in the onions and then add enough olive oil until it tastes like my recipe, you know, which is not a measurement. And, like, this book, you could just get it for, like, the first essay alone because I was crying. I was just like, ah, you know, it was so good. And also it's, like, the weight of the world, you know, so I cry much more easily now. But, you know, she talks about, like I said, she growing up alone, being an only child, the distance that she felt from her heritage, about being the child of an immigrant. And she also talks about her experiences being the only Asian American in her school, her life in a rock band. She's in a singer and a guitarist from an indie rock band. And then she talks about her mother's illness and eventual death from pancreatic cancer and that, you know, loss in her life and what that feels like. So get ready to cry a lot because it's so moving and it's just so beautiful. But she's also an incredible writer, and these are beautiful, evocative stories about her life. I will give content warnings for death and illness, grief and trauma and racism. But this is definitely a memoir worth picking up. It is called Crying in H Mart, a memoir by Michelle Zauner.
I've seen that book like 5 times this week.
Yeah.
Alone. So well, there yes, you go. I feel like it's popping up everywhere. So
it's really great. It's getting amazing reviews. Oh,
that's amazing. All right. My next pick is The Half Orphan's Handbook by Joan F. Smith. And just a heads up, I'm going to discuss parent death and death by suicide and addiction here. So this is just an incredible, tremendous book about Lila, who is a teenager who, before the book starts, about 2 months beforehand, she loses her father to suicide. And so she is just like in the throes of grief. Like, she and her mom and her younger brother are having a really, really tough time because, you know, not only have they lost like a husband and a father, but it was a really like shocking death and they didn't see it coming. And they just are really struggling to make sense of it and all of like the messiness that has been left in the wake of his death. And so Lila has pretty much pulled away from everything that she once did in life. Like, she quit the hurdling team. She doesn't really hang out with her friends anymore. She mostly just hangs out with her mom and her little brother. And now it's almost summer and her mom proposes that she and her little brother go to this camp. And it's basically like a grief camp because the only kids who go there are kids who have lost an immediate family member. And Lila absolutely does not want to go. And she's really like fighting her mom tooth and nail on this, saying like, you know, why should I have to go to camp? Like, I don't want to be away from you for 2 months. Like, we can't afford it. Like, we just need to stick together. And her mom is basically just like, you know, you need to start healing. I need to start healing. And I love you, but like also I need a little bit of space as well. So that kind of convinces Lila, although she's not very happy about it. She and her brother head off to this camp that is like in the woods of New England. And it's really fascinating because in this book, it is basically a camp that was started by a very rich person after 9/11. And it was originally this camp where kids who lost one or both parents in 9/11 could come to this camp and basically have like all the summer camp fun activities. But then like 3 times a week, they would do group therapy for grief healing. And so, and this is actually inspired by a camp that really did exist. I believe it's no longer in existence. I think it shut down once all of the kids that were affected by 9/11 grew into adults. But Joan F. Smith like read about this camp, and so that is what she models her camp on. And now that all of the kids who, you know, were a part of it in the book like have aged out of it, basically, the premise is that like one of those kids who lost the parent in 9/11 has come back and reopened it and now has broadened it so every kid who has lost a parent or a sibling can come and attend. So anywho, Lila, her grief is very, very real. It's very, very sharp still. And she is not happy about being there, even though she's surrounded by these people who, like, in theory, are supposed to be able to get what it's like even more than, you know, her friends and the people that she goes to school with. She's still so raw that she's not really feeling like she wants to reach out to them. And she thinks she's only going to stay for just a week. But of course, she doesn't end up staying for just a week. And it's just, I don't know, it's a really beautiful book about grief. And it really takes you to, you know, those really emotionally intense places. I would say that the closest thing that I can think about in terms of like what it was like reading this book and really feeling all of those strong emotions was the experience of reading The Astonishing Color of After by Emily XR Pan, which is just a tremendous, beautiful book. This one, you know, doesn't have like those magical elements that The Astonishing Color of After does, but it's really great. And as you get deeper into the book, Lila learns that her father was addicted to something and that there are circumstances about his death that she doesn't understand and know fully. And her mom is not quite able to tell her at the beginning of the book. So it's, you know, part camp story, part grief journey, but also like part exploration of like what really did happen to her father. And it allows Lila to start seeing her father a little bit more fully. So I highly recommend this book. It was actually supposed to come out a couple of weeks ago, but it got delayed a couple of weeks, which is, you know, kind of a bummer, but like great for me because I got to talk about it on this podcast. And I highly recommend you go pick up a copy. That's The Half Orphan's Handbook by Joan F. Smith.
Okay, before I tell you about my next book, we are going to hear from a sponsor.
Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge, strategy, and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate, high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, okay, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and, oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family and lovers and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode.
All right, so my next pick today is Witches Steeped in Gold by Shannon Smart. Shannon is spelled C-I-A-N-N-O-N, for those of you that are trying to look it up. This is a fantastic new YA fantasy novel. It's steeped in Jamaican stories and legends and full of political intrigue. And can I just tell you how my pandemic brain is working these days? I was writing my notes and I was like, steeped in Jamaican stories. I'm like, steeped is such a great word. Way to go. And then like a few beats later, I was like, it's in the title. Like, it's just like, I thought of this. No, I did not. I definitely did not think of this word. But in the beginning, there's a little beginning from the author about how Smart had Jamaican parents, but she grew up in England and she visited Jamaica for the first time when she was 12. And that's where she said she really learned about the island, and she learned about her heritage and her culture that was really entrenched in magic. She said she learned some really amazing things that really excited her, but also made her keep her bedroom windows locked at night. But it's like magic. Like, that's an exciting thing to learn about when you're a 12-year-old. And she said that's really where the idea for this book started. And so it's a Jamaican-inspired fantasy about two enemy witches who are forced to work together to rid themselves of a common enemy. And both use magic that is drawn from the same place, but they use it in different ways, different forms of magic, and both see the other's way as the wrong way. Jasmine is the daughter of the queen, but we find out she has, well, most importantly, we find out that she has a lizard dog, which is awesome, but I guess for the sake of this, like the actual story, we find out that she has joined the resistance. And Araya has vengeance on her mind. She wants the queen gone. And even Jasmine, like, realizes her mother must go. So they're going to work together to bring down the queen. It keeps getting compared to Killing Eve, which I guess I have not watched enough of to go with on that sort of comparison. But it is really interesting in that, you know, each sees the other as the villain of the story, which is like a really interesting thing to think about. Like, you know, are you the hero of your story? If you are, then who's the villain? And like, they each think, you know, they're the hero of their own story. And, you know, like how even though they don't like each other, they're going to have to call a truce to get rid of like the big bad, who is Jasmine's mother. I really liked the descriptions of magic. I didn't think it was too complicated for me to follow. I know that there are a lot of readers of YA fantasy out there who are a lot more critical than I am and need the magic to work and need the system, you know, to be described perfectly and make all kinds of sense. Me personally, they're like, it's magic. It comes out the end of the wand and bazoom and sparks and whatever. And I'm like, yay, magic, because I guess that's all I need. But I thought, you know, it was really well done. And I really, like I said, I really like the examination of working with your enemy and how there are two sides to every story. It doesn't mean that one of those sides is correct, but there are almost two sides to every story. If you like morally gray characters, betrayal, revenge, royal political intrigue, and magic, and excellent world building. I highly recommend this book. It is the first in a series. The second one, I think I read that it was coming next year, beginning of next year. I do want to give content warnings for psychological warfare, death, murder, bullying, oppression and imprisonment, death of a parent or sibling, gore, grief, physical abuse, mentions of sexual assault, mentions of suicide, torture, and violence. That was a lot of content warnings. But, you know, we like to make sure we cover everything. So it is called Witches Steeped in Gold, and it's by Shannon Smart.
Oh, yes. Also on my TBR, I just downloaded the audiobook for that, so I'm excited.
Oh, I don't know what it is, but recently I'm super into, like, YA royalty backstabbing political intrigue books. I don't know what happened.
Yes.
But that's what I want.
I love it. All right. So my last pick is another book by the author of, like, one of my favorite books that I read last year. My last pick is She Drives Me Crazy by Kelly Quinlan. And Kelly Quinlan wrote Late to the Party, which I loved so much. And I know I raved about it last year, but definitely go pick that up if you like queer YA novels and friendship stories and like big friend groups and all of that fun stuff. She Drives Me Crazy. I have to admit, I've not finished reading it yet because this was like a crazy week, but I am so excited to finish reading it because I am like so hooked in just like the first half. So it starts out with Scotty, who is a basketball player, and she is playing like this sort of preseason game with their school's rival. And it's really hard for her. She's totally off of her game because the new star player on their other team that they're playing against is Scotty's ex-girlfriend. And Scotty's ex-girlfriend, Tally, not only did she transfer to this other school where she now plays basketball, but she broke up with Scotty right before she transferred because she just wanted this like clean break, even though like their towns are literally like right next to each other. It's not like, you know, we're breaking up because I'm moving away or because it'd be long distance. It was just like, no, I'm starting over at this new school. We're breaking up. So she is still devastated. And at this preseason game, Scotty's totally off her game. She kind of behaves in a way that's a little bit embarrassing to her and, you know, to the rest of her team. And they lose the game spectacularly. And she's so thrown off her game that right after the actual game, she is getting in her car to drive home. And she has a fender bender with Irene. And Irene is the, like, school's top cheerleader. And I mean, I hesitate to use the word queen bee because that feels very, you know, very 1990s sort of dated, but kind of like the queen bee where she is very popular. She has a lot of attention and she is kind of, you know, she kind of comes across as like the mean girl. Although the more you start to get to know her, you realize that she's not really mean per se. She just has kind of an abrasive sense of humor that puts Scotty on edge. So because of this fender bender, which was technically Irene's fault, their moms get together and they decide that like Scotty needs to give Irene rides to and from school every day because they live close by and Scotty's car is in good shape and they assume that their daughters are friends. And it's just like absolutely miserable for Scotty. And Irene doesn't seem too happy about it either. But as they get to know each other and as Scotty seems to like get more and more drawn into the antics of her very, very toxic ex Tally, she decides to bribe Irene into pretending to be her fake girlfriend because Tally hears that Scotty is giving Irene rides and she becomes like really jealous. And so Scotty's thinking like, oh, you know, maybe I can lure Tally back and, you know, get her back into like wanting to have a relationship with me. And that, of course, like we know never goes as planned. And it's so funny because I was reading this book and I'm just like cringing because Tally is so toxic and she's such a bad ex. And I'm like, don't, why do you want her? But like, I also know, you know, when you're young and you are in love, you can sometimes overlook and excuse another person's behavior if you, you know, think you're in love with them. So I just really I enjoy fake dating. I love the fact that this is a YA novel that is about queer teens, and like Late to the Party, like the queerness is not a huge deal. It's not like, you know, a coming out story or a story of trauma. This is just a really, really fun high school set book with like romance and drama galore and hijinks. And I'm just having a lot of fun reading it. I can't wait to finish it. Also, I have to make a note about the town that they live in. Their town is named after a local woman who like established a year-round Christmas emporium, and it's become like a really big deal. So they name the town after this grandma who establishes this place. So it's like, I'm forgetting the exact name, but like literally the name of the town is like grandma, the name of for this person. So like she is like going to grandma something high school, and because like the year-round Christmas thing is like such a big deal in their town, their school mascot is the reindeer. So it's really funny. I just loved that that detail. It really made this book stand out to me. So that is She Drives Me Crazy by Kelly Quinlan. I can't wait to finish it. I think I said this last year, but Late to the Party made Kelly Quinlan an auto-buy author for me, and this one has not disappointed so far.
Ooh, I think I have that one. I didn't read much about it, but I will definitely bump it up in the piles. And piles and piles and piles and piles. For my last pick today, I'm actually going to mention a few books that I talked about on the show that I absolutely loved that came out a few weeks back or more that I feel like they need to be revisited if you're looking for really great reads, because it's already April. We're a third of the way into the year. A third? Yeah, that's how math works. And so I wanted to mention a few because I just love these books so much, and I can't stop talking about them still. And then, you know, we'll move on to what we're reading next. But first, I want to bring these up. There is The Rib King by Lady Hubbard, which is set in the early 20th century about the all-black staff of a once prominent white family there's infighting amongst the staff while the owners of the home are losing all their money and trying to keep up appearances, and it's not working. And then there's an incident that takes place. And then the second part of the book is 10 years later and involves one of the staff members and her life after this incident. There's so much more to it than that, but that is like the briefest description I can give it. I love this book so much, so, so, so much. As well as In the Quick by Kate Hope Day, which is about a young girl who is an absolute genius who goes to space school because this is the future and you can go to space school, but not like fancy, you know, like lights and lasers and all kinds of space school, like sleeping in a corrugated metal shack sort of bunker with a bunch of other students. And, you know, the equipment is always breaking. And, you know, this isn't like a fancy kind of future that we see usually, but like a sort of like a realistic one where, you know, schools aren't funded very well. But she wants to go to space because her uncle was a genius and he wanted to go to space and she's going to do it. And it involves the story of a missing shuttle that she thinks she knows where it is, and no one wants to believe her because she's so young. It's fantastic. I also love We Could Be Heroes by Mike Chen. This is about two people who are in a similar situation. They wake up one day, they don't know who they are or where they are or how they got there. But according to some notes that are left in these, they wake up separately, they're in different apartments. According to some notes that are left behind, you know, it's like everything is fine and this is where you live and this is who you are. But they both also have superpowers. And one of them decides to use them for good and one of them decides to use them for bad. And they eventually come up against each other because that's what happens when villains and heroes, you know, have superpowers. But then they discover that their backgrounds are very similar and they become really good buds. And I just thought it was a delight. I thought the friendship was so great and it's just so charming. It's We Could Be Heroes by Mike Chen. I also really love Picnic in the Ruins by Todd Robert Peterson, which is about a young anthropologist who's working on a site in like on the Arizona-Utah border. And it also involves these two sort of inept criminals who are trying to pull off a robbery and things go wrong. And now a much more dangerous criminal is looking for them and the anthropologist who gets mixed up in all of it. I thought it was excellent. It's kind of like No Country for Old Men meets Northern Exposure is the best way I could describe it. Like quirky small town, but also like dangerous sort of criminals. I really loved it. And last but not least is Good Neighbors by Sarah Langan, which is the darkest, it has to be the darkest book I've ever read, but so incredible. And so many of you have read it since I mentioned it on the show, and you all seem to have had the same reaction. Like, you finish it, you're like, I loved that book. What is wrong with me? That's exactly how I felt when I finished it, because it's about this supposedly perfect neighborhood in this cul-de-sac on Long Island, and these neighbors who move in who don't quite fit in, and the, like, head of the neighborhood who sort of takes it upon herself to help them fit in and welcome them into the neighborhood, but then something doesn't go according to her plan, and now they are her mortal enemy, and she wants to ruin them. And while the grown-ups are fighting, things are going horribly between the other kids in the neighborhood. And it all takes a very, very, very dark turn. And it's so excellent. So that is Good Neighbors by Sarah Langan. Those are my favorite books of the year that are out so far, that came out, you know, several weeks ago. Of course, there's The Five Wounds that I talked about, I think, last week or 2 weeks ago, and Elizabeth McCracken. But I wanted to, you know, put those back on your radar. And that's it for our new books.
Yeah.
Tirza, what are you going to read next?
I'm going to read She's Too Pretty to Burn by Wendy Hurd, which, you know, just came out last month. But I was fortunate enough to be able to do an event with Wendy last night, actually, and it was so much fun. And I hadn't had a chance to pick up her book before the event, but definitely after reading, or like just having that event with her and having her talk about her book, I was like, oh my goodness, I have to read it. It is a retelling of The Picture of Dorian Gray, but it's gender swapped and it's about queer teenage girls and it's a thriller, and I'm like, sign me up. So I think I'm going to read that this weekend.
I actually had the good fortune of being one of a handful of people who learned last year that Nick Harkaway, who is one of my very favorite authors, wrote The Gone Away World and Angel Maker and a bunch of other great books. He wrote a thriller last year under a pseudonym. It was called The Price You Pay by Aidan Truin, and it was actually Nick Harkaway. And now the second book is coming out, and they're advertising this is Nick Harkaway writing as Aidan Truin. And it's so exciting because I love everything that he does. And I loved the first book. I loved it so much that I bought a copy that is in German. I don't speak German, but the German title of this book is F You Very Much, but not F. And it has the most incredible cover of just someone giving the bird with a skull ring on. And I was like, I need to have that. Like, there's no way that I could pass that up, but maybe I'll learn German just to read it. But the second one is called Seven Demons. It comes out in May. It's very exciting for me and for all of you Nick Harkaway fans out there. And that's it for today. I feel like we covered a lot of ground today. Books.
We really did.
Shirt tails. Cats. Cats. Always cats. That's pretty normal. Yeah, just like a whole bunch of great stuff. So thank you to everyone for listening. Thank you to our sponsors. Thank you to our awesome audio editor, Jen Zink. You can drop us a line at allthebooks@bookriot.com if you want to talk about Shirt Tales. You can find us online. Tirza hangs out on Instagram and Twitter at Tirza Price. It's TirzaHPrice. I mostly hang out on Instagram at Franzen Comes Alive, although I have been talking a lot about books on Twitter lately, which is under Miss Liberty, so maybe you could find me there. And if you want to give us a treat, you can go to Apple Podcasts and leave a rating or review. It helps other book lovers to find us. As much as we would love to tell you about more books today, we just don't have the time, but you can read about more titles out now in the show notes at bookriot.com/allthebooks, as well as find a link to our weekly new books newsletter. And for more recs or general bookishness, check out bookriot.com, and don't forget to check out our full stable of podcasts at bookriot.com/listen, or just search Book Riot on your podcast player of choice. And in the meantime, happy reading!
Happy reading!